My pleasure to welcome and introduce Barbara Brandt to the podium. Barbara is a member of the Board of Trustees of the Council and the chair of the Council's Women in International Affairs series. She will introduce our guest speaker. Please help me welcome Barbara Brandt.
I'm not trying to be a stand-in for our guest from Washington who was unable to make it, but I am very, very pleased to have the opportunity to introduce our guest today. And if you will forgive me, I'm going to read because her bio was this thick and her honors list this thick. We are really fortunate today to have in our presence the formidable force in America's civil rights movement, Dolores Huerta. In 1962, Ms. Huerta, along with activist Cesar Chavez, founded the organization that later evolved into the United Farm Workers of America. Ms. Huerta became the first vice president emeritus of the United Farm Workers at that time. For more than 40 years, she has been the voice for women, Latinos, immigrants, and farm workers in the labor movement in our country. She led the famous Delano grape strike, resulting in the first historical negotiation committee comprised of farm workers, and successfully negotiated a collective bargaining agreement with an agricultural corporation. Through her dedicated years of lobbying on the workers' behalf, Ms. Huerta is responsible for organizing the first contracts that established health and benefit plans and secured unemployment benefits for farm workers. These are no small tasks. Furthermore, her efforts led to both the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, the first law of its kind in the United States of America. It granted farm workers the right to collectively organize and bargain. She also was the initiator of the Immigration Act of 1985, granting amnesty to farm workers that lived, worked, and paid taxes in the United States, but were unable to enjoy the privilege of citizenship. Remaining close to Mr. Chavez, most loyal and trusted advisor for over 30 years, someone that I personally always wanted to meet but never had the opportunity to do so. Together they founded a multitude of institutions in this country. The Robert F. Kennedy Medical Plan, the Juan de la Cruz Farm Worker Pension Fund, the Farm Workers Credit Union, and the National Farm Workers Service Center. Ms. Huerta remains passionate. I had the opportunity to talk with her just a few minutes before we sat down, and I can attest to her passion about her work and is active in her promotion of the farm workers' cause and women's rights. She has been awarded the American Civil Liberties Union Roger Baldwin Medal of Liberty Award, the Eugene Debs Foundation Outstanding American Award, and the Ellis Island Medal of Freedom Award. In 1963, she was also inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Currently, Ms. Huerta is Secretary Treasurer Emeritus of the United Farm Workers of America and President of the Dolores Huerta Foundation. She is noted as one of the most successful and respected labor movement leaders of the 20th century. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished, honorable, accomplished, remarkable guest, Ms. Dolores Huerta.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Barbara, and thank you, Mr. Alcada. And I want to thank all of you for attending this luncheon and also the World Council for inviting me and also for having this organization, which is such an important organization. I would hope that someday you'll have one in every single city throughout the United States of America, because we know that what happens in our world is affecting us daily. And unfortunately, we have so much ignorance in our society about the rest of the world, which makes it sad when you consider how which a powerful country we are, the United States of America, and how what we do impacts the rest of the world. It definitely then what happens over there impacts on us. So it's very important that this organization be spread throughout the country, and so that people will start thinking in terms of not only our country, but thinking in terms of world affairs and how they affect us. So, and it's interesting because when I arrived in Ohio, they were telling me that, as an example, that you will soon have maybe an initiative on your ballot for English only, right? And when we think about how ridiculous that is, that we're still talking about that kind of xenophobia as English only, when at the same time we know that we are now in the midst of globalization, and that we have you know, money that crosses borders, we have jobs that cross borders, and except of course the people that try to cross the border are the ones that get arrested, right? It's okay to move the money, it's okay to move, move products, but when the people try to move, of course, maybe that's not so good, right? That's not okay. It was interesting, the song that was sang just a few months ago that we heard, and the Spanish words were about the sun, and the words were sol que eres tan parejo, you know, repartiendo tu luz. The sun is shedding its light and its warmth in a very even manner over everybody. You know, sol que eres, sun that you are, that you are shedding your light in a very even way, and that everybody then is comforted by the sun. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we would think in terms of globally, that the wealth of the world would also be spread evenly, and so that all could benefit from the warmth of our prosperity instead of just a few, the way that it is now. When we talk about immigration, and I have to ask this question, and we talk about what a crisis this is, that we're now in immigration, and we think, well, let's look at this so-called crisis. Is it really a crisis? When you have a lot of people in our country that are undocumented, that are working, that are contributing to the society, that are kind of holding up our economy because they're not being given the benefits of Social Security, unemployment insurance, all of these other benefits that American workers are supposed to receive. And yet they're contributing so much, not only with their sweat of their labor, but also with their tax dollars, which they're not getting back. You know, they're providing all these tax dollars. Every time that they buy anything, they're paying taxes. And so, you know, where is the crisis at? Is it with these folks here that are the victims, or is it with the beneficiaries, and we are the beneficiaries? And so I just want to start out by saying that I think that so-called attack on immigrants and the so-called crisis on immigration is really a distraction. And I'm going to put it in the same level of the distraction that we have in the war against women, the war against women's rights, the women's rights to choose. In the same category as the attack on gays and lesbians, right? Is that a crisis? You know, but we see a lot of publicity about this, and there's a lot of focus on these so-called moral values. And I just have to say that, you know, when you talk about human rights of gays and lesbians, and you ask the question, if Thelma and Louise get married, does that affect your paycheck? I don't think it does, right? Those are privacy issues. Those are constitutional issues. When you talk about a woman's right to choose, part of my biography that Barbara didn't read is that I have 11 children. Well, I mean, does that mean that everybody needs to have 11 children? Of course not, right? That was my choice. And again, a person and a family, a woman's right to choose is her right. How many children she decides she wants to have. That is a constitutional right. These are privacy issues, right? And so why do we have so much focus on those issues? Is it because what we really want to do when we attack gays and lesbians, when we attack women's right to choose, when we attack immigrants, is it because it's really a distraction about what are the real issues that are affecting our country and our families? You know, the war in Iraq, the money that is going to pay for that war, what's happening to our economy, what's happening to our tax dollars. Our tax dollars, it should be used for health. You know, Americans pay more money for health care than any other country in the world. Yet we're the only industrialized country that doesn't have a national health care. When we talk about education, our money should be coming for education, and it's not. You know, we're spending more in California, at least, and I don't know about Ohio, but we're spending as much money on prisons right now as we are for higher education in the state of California. So these are issues that really, really impact on our families. But instead, you know, the drums that we're hearing and the clamor that we're hearing is about immigration. And we have some of our congresspeople that are saying, let's build a border, let's build a wall, all the way from, you know, Florida or from Texas, you know, all along Texas, all the way to California. We should build this big wall to keep out the terrorists that are coming in from Mexico, right? Well, if I remember correctly, the only terrorists that came into the United States came into the Canadian border, right? Not to the Mexican border. And then, of course, they were caught. So, but I think if our congresspeople were supposed to, were to say, let's build a wall across the Canadian border, people would not put up with that, right? Now, why is that? Why is it that we can say, build a wall on the Mexican border and not the Canadian border? We might question then, does that really have kind of a little racist tinge to it, right? We need to keep the Mexicans out and not the Canadians? And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves this question. And I think that the racism is a very big part of what's happening now in this whole cry for immigration reform. And if we look at the history of the United States, we had during the, during World War II, we had this Bracero program where people were brought in from Mexico by the millions. And it happened starting from 1942 or 43, right when the war broke out, because if you'll remember that a lot of our people went to the war, so they needed labor, especially for our agricultural fields. So a lot of Mexicans were brought in. It was kind of interesting. In my town where I grew up in Stockton, California, we had a lot of the World War II prisoners from Germany and Italy, and they were housed there in Stockton, California, and they were all in these neat little white cottages, and they would bring the prisoners of war into town. They would take them to the movies, and, you know, they were kind of treated like fairly decently. But the Mexicans that were brought in to work in our fields during the Bracero program, they had them behind barbed wire, right, in these really, really ugly barracks. And people that tried to go in and see the relatives weren't allowed to. So one had to ask the question, who were the prisoners of war? Were they the Mexicans, or were they the prisoners of war from Italy and Germany? It was kind of interesting. And that, again, I think reflects sort of kind of the racism that we have in our society. Well, what happened after the Bracero program finally ended, during the course from 1942 up to 1964, that program went on forever, that many of these people brought in, there were families that were disrupted, et cetera. And everybody denounced the program, and we finally ended it. But one of the problems is that the wages had been dropped so low during that time that the farm workers themselves, the local farm workers, were suffering. Wages were down to like 50 cents an hour. And that is, of course, what are the impetus that started us to organize the United Farm Workers Union. But when that program ended in 1964, there was a legalization program in the United States. And interestingly enough, it happened without any legislation. They just did it, you know? 500,000 of the ex-braceros were then given immigration status, and their families were also brought in without any legislation. It just happened. So then, 20 years down the line, we have a big fur about immigration again. And in 1984, we had another law that was passed that legalized 3 million undocumented residents of the United States. And among those were 1,400,000 farm workers that were legalized. So here we are in the year 2005, right? We go 20 years down the line, and again we have the same fur about immigration. And you know what? I am predicting that we're going to have another legalization bill. It's going to happen. Because it's like you can't ignore the elephant in the room. The people are already here. They're here, they're working, you know, they're contributing to the society. And it's interesting that we never blame the employers that bring in the workers. These workers don't just come by accident. They're actually recruited, and they're brought into the United States. There's employers there that are willing to hire them. And so they create the situation. But again, we blame the immigrants. We don't blame them. The other thing that we have to look at, when we talk about immigration, we have to talk about our policies. Policies of the United States of America that create the immigration. You know, when we have to go back to when Ronald Reagan was president, we had the wars in Central America. And you know, when we were in there and we were bombing El Salvador. By the way, there's a really great movie called Innocent Voices. I urge everybody to see that movie. I don't know if it's playing here or not, but try to look for it and find it. And this movie depicts what was happening in El Salvador, and it's why so many people had to leave El Salvador, because they were, you know, they were getting killed because of the wars in El Salvador. And the United States had a very key role in making that war happen, as of course we did also in Nicaragua. So all of the immigrants from Central America that came here, and let's add Guatemala into the picture also, they came here escaping those wars. People don't want to leave their homeland. The only reason that they leave is because they have to, you know, because they're escaping poverty, or they're escaping wars, and then they come to the United States. Then we have our other laws that we've passed, like NAFTA, the free trade agreements. There is no way in the world that a small farmer in Mexico can compete with agribusiness. No way. We have, in the Farm Workers Union, there's one family in particular that they had a small farm in Mexico. They hired 40 workers. What happened? They were put out of business. That farmer is here with all of the 40 workers that used to work at his ranch. You know, they all had to come to the United States. So we really have to look at our policies and to see, because the problem doesn't start over there, the problem starts here in the United States of America. It starts right here. And now we just passed CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And that just passed the Congress by a couple of votes, but it passed. And that's going to create, again, more problems over there. And there's a big difference in the way that we treat Latin America in the way that we treated, say, for instance, Japan and Germany. And I like to refer to that because during World War II, we know that Germany and Japan were the enemies of the United States. These are the people that we were fighting. Well, we won that war, but those countries were pretty much destroyed. So what did the United States do? We lent Germany and Japan money to build up their infrastructure and to build up their economy. And after we gave them these massive loans to build up their economies, we forgave the loans. We forgave the loans. So the difference between what we did there and what we're doing in Latin America is that we actually help these countries build their economies. What we do over here with NAFTA and CAFTA is that American companies go into Mexico, they go into Central America, they go into South America, and it's American companies then that are using the resources, using the labor, and taking out the profits, right? From those countries. The profits do not stay there. They come back over here, you know? And those people that are working in these sweatshops, they really don't make a lot of money. They barely make enough money to survive. You know, they don't make a lot of money. And in some of the areas we have like disastrous consequences, like in Juarez, Mexico, where you've had close to 400 women that have been raped and murdered. And many of those women that were raped and murdered worked at these sweatshops in Mexico. And I just want to talk about it just for a second. I went with a congressional delegation to Juarez, Mexico, and we met with the owners of the maquiladoras, they call them, these big, beautiful factories. These factories are state of the art. They're absolutely just beautiful. And when we met with the owners and we said to them, what are you doing about protecting the lives of these women? And they showed us a picture. They showed us a picture of a young woman, and it said in Spanish, cuídate, which means take care of yourself. And then they had another poster that they had in the factory, and that poster said, don't walk in the dark, don't walk in the dark. Well, you know what? Where these young women lived, there are no lights. I mean, going from the beautiful factories and then going to the homes where these women lived and these families lived, it's just horrible. I mean, they didn't have street lights. They didn't have water for a long time. They got water not too long ago. There's nothing but dirt and stones and just these little squatter's huts that they built for themselves. Horrible. So you would think of these American companies, if these companies would go in there to make all this money by paying these very low wages, that they would at least care about the people that work there. But And I think so that our philosophy as a country has got to change. We can't just think that all of these countries are there for us to go in and exploit and to take out their resources and to use their people, you know? We have to think in terms of using our power, how can we go into these countries and help them make their lives better? Every one of those countries in Mexico, Latin America, Central America, there is so much work to be done just in building their own infrastructure, just in helping them build their own infrastructure and say, okay, we're going to help you, but you've got to do something to develop your economies. Now we're going to go in there and take it over, which has been our philosophy. And as I say, what we did before with Japan and Germany, why can't we use that same model and use that with our other countries that we're supposedly trying to help, right? Instead of making it like the imperialistic positions that we've had recently, it's almost like a second colonization. You know, sometimes I think that if we go back into history, and recently I just talked to a group of high school students and we were talking about Africa, but if we go back into world history and we think of all of the European countries that came in there and colonized Latin America and that colonized Africa, and they took all of the gold and the diamonds and all of the riches from these countries, if somehow they had to give it back with interest, right? Couldn't you just kind of erase a lot of the poverty that now exists? You know, so I think that, you know, one thing about organizing, when Cecil and I started organizing the farm workers, everybody said to us, you can't organize farm workers. You know, they're too poor. They don't speak English. And they're migrant. You know, and in those days, by the way, we had nothing like unemployment insurance or food stamps. When farm workers finished the harvest, they had to go on and move on to the next town to be able to feed their families. In fact, the farm worker, I remember, said to us, they will put a man on the moon before farm workers get unemployment insurance. And we did. We put a man on the moon in 1969. And in California, we did not get unemployment insurance till 1975 when Jerry Brown got elected governor of California, and then we got the law to allow farm workers to organize. And I'll bet in Ohio, you still don't have unemployment insurance for farm workers. And somebody might ask the question, you know, do you or do you not? In fact, most of the states don't even have workers' compensation for farm workers. If they get hurt on the job, they're out of luck. You know, their medical bills don't get paid, they don't get any kind of disability payment. And I say this because it shows how retarded we are in terms of a country, in terms of our social policies, is the way that we treat working people. You know, the farm workers, which are the most, you know, sacred people of all, because they put our food on our table. And I like to say to students, if you had to go on a deserted island and you could only take one person with you, you know, like Survivor, that program, would you take a farm worker or an attorney? And I think it kind of it kind of brings the message home, right? You know, and it shows you how you know, sometimes we have our priorities upside down, you know, and backwards, right? But the thing is that when we started organized farm workers, the one thing that we had to do to farm workers is we had to say to them, nobody can do this for you. You've got to take responsibility. You've got to do this for yourselves, right? You've got to do this for yourselves. And if you don't organize, if you don't stand up, if you don't march and strike and go out there and do boycotts, nothing's ever going to change for you. And they did it. The farm workers did it. And I think that that's kind of the message that we have to have for ourselves also, that as a country, as the United States of America, a citizen of the United States of America, we've got to start taking responsibility. And we can't just say, leave it up to our legislators, all right? We've got to tell them. We've got to give them the advice. I think we have to constantly remind ourselves that our president, who does he work for? Works for us, right? Who pays the salary? We do, right? Our senators, our congresspeople, our legislators in the state capitals, who do they work for? They work for us, and we've got to make them accountable, and we've got to make them responsible, and we've got to find out what's going on, and not just believe what we're told in the press about how great things are. You know, in our evening news, what do we get? We get the local crime report, right? All the car chases and the burglaries and the murders. And you know, if a murder happens in Florida, you're going to hear about it in Ohio, right? You know, because we're all supposed to live in this constant state of fear. What we don't get, and I tell people, read the business section of the newspaper. That's the other crime report, right? These are, you know, you read about all these guys that are either going to jail or should be going to jail, right? And they don't steal, you know, it's not like these petty theft and the burglary. I mean, these guys are stealing millions of dollars and getting away with it. And yet, you know, we don't, because they have good attorneys, right, that can defend them. And so we really got to find out what's going on in our country, what's going on with our tax dollars, what's going on with our foreign policy, and start looking behind what we see, you know, on the evening news, because we're not going to get the information there. You know, we've got to read Nation Magazine, read the American Prospect, right? Read the Economist. Let's look at some of these other newspapers and periodicals that really give us the true story about what's going on. And in terms of immigration, the Bush's proposals for guest worker programs are not good. They're not good. This is a slave program. This is what this is. It's a slave program. People are going to be brought in. They're going to be working 30 or 40 miles outside of Ohio on some of these farm belts out here. They're not going to get decent wages. There's nobody, and every single time that they've had guest workers, and we do have that program on the East Coast, the H-2A it's called, every time that they violated the law, you know, they've always been found guilty. There's no way that they can police this kind of a program to make sure that workers are treated justly. And one other thing is that we have right now restrictions in the law that say they cannot bring in foreign workers unless they pay prevailing wages, unless they recruit local farm workers or other people that want to do the jobs. We have unemployment. In our African American community, we have huge unemployment. You know, that racism still continues in this country, you know? And we don't have what you call a labor shortage, you have a wage shortage and a benefit shortage, that people are not getting decent wages or they're not getting decent benefits. And it's interesting, again, talking to the high school students this morning, and they were saying to me, don't you think a hike in the minimum wage is bad? No, it's not, you know? If the minimum wage is raised, that means people have money to spend into their local stores, the grocery stores, the retail stores, and the whole economy gets lifted up. And it's so sad to think that young people would think that raising the minimum wage is bad. And if the minimum wage were to be where it's supposed to be, if the minimum wage would have kept up with inflation, our minimum wage today should be $15 an hour. $15 an hour. That's how far behind we are in our economy right now. But people aren't paying attention. I was with Cindy Sheehan the other night. And Cindy Sheehan, who you know is the woman who set up a compound there in front of George Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, and she lost her son Casey in the war. And when I heard Cindy speak, she read a poem that one daughter had written. And the poem said, "America has been rocked to sleep. America has been rocked to sleep." Well, I remember at the Democratic Convention in 1968, there was a great woman named Fannie Lou Hamer, and she came to that convention and she yelled out, "America, wake up! Wake up, America!" And her battle cry, you know, was like that. She aroused that convention, and they had formed this Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party because they were contesting the fact that African Americans didn't have the right to vote in Mississippi and in the South. And it was one of the cries, along with, you know, the murder of Emmett Till, along with Rosa Parks, Dr. King, that started that civil rights movement. Well, you know what? We need a new movement here in the United States. We need a movement for economic justice. It is not right that our CEOs of companies get 400 times more than a worker gets. 40 years ago, a CEO got 40 times more than a worker. That our CEOs of Fortune 500 companies have an average salary of $3 million to $9 million a year. When you think about, you know, I remember my economics teacher told me, no matter how much money you have, you can only eat three meals a day. You can only eat three meals a day. You can only wear one suit of clothes a day. And the legacy that we want to leave our children is one of justice, not property or jewels, because they'll fight over that, right? So if you leave them the love for justice, you know, that is a much better inheritance to leave our children. And we've all got to fight really hard to end the racism in our society. The only reason it's so easy to attack immigrants is because they happen to be brown, right? And that's why it's easy to attack them. And unless we start really teaching our children, you know, what the contributions of people of color have been to this country, you know, Native Americans whose land we took that we're sitting on right now, with no thank yous or no reparations. The children of African Americans, descendants of people that were brought here in chains, and that we still have never done anything to repair that damage. So these are things that we have to change, and we have to start insisting that we include K through 12, the true story of America, the exploitation, the people that have built this country, you know, Asians that were brought here also, and maybe someday we can end it. And when we end racism here, then that means it will affect our foreign policies in other countries, because I don't think we would be bombing Iraq if the population there was Caucasian. You know, we would not be doing that. So we really got to look into our inner souls and see how we can save our democracy, how we can save our country, and I think that will impact our foreign policy. So I want to just close, and I don't know if we have time for questions or not. We do? Okay, good. So I want to close by asking you all to join me in a good old farm worker, Viva, okay? We want to do it for peace, for justice, and one for Cesar Chavez, who was such a great human being. But I also want to teach you a new word, one from South Africa. And this is a Zulu word. And when I use this word, it's just kind of a reminder to all of us that we are one human race. Homo sapiens sapien, right? One human race. And where did our human race begin? Africa, right? So we always have to remember that we are all Africans of different shades and colors. And if we can remember that, then we will end racism in our society. That we all have to treat each other as if we were all sisters and brothers and cousins. And I believe you said this morning we were all 34 times removed from each other, right, in terms of being relationships. So the word I want to teach you is Wozani. And it means people are coming together to fight for justice, okay? The people are coming together to fight for justice. So I want you to say that word with me. I'm going to say 1, 2, 3, and I want all of you to shout Wozani at the top of your lungs, okay? Pretend you're farm workers, okay? Okay, so we'll say Wozani first, and then we'll say the Vivas, okay? I'll go first. I'll say 1, 2, 3, I'll shout Wozani. 1, 2, 3, Wozani! 1, 2, 3, Wozani! 1, 2, 3, Wozani! Okay, now we'll do a couple of Vivas. We'll say one for peace, I'll say Viva la Paz, everybody shout Viva, and then I'll say Viva la Justicia, which is Spanish for justice, okay? And just shout Viva again at the top of your lungs. Viva la Paz!
Viva!
Louder. Okay, I think we can do better than that. Come on, Ohio. Let's go. Okay? Viva la Paz!
Viva!
Viva la Justicia!
Viva!
Viva Cesar Chavez!
Viva!
Now, can we keep our democracy, fight for our democracy? Can we build peace throughout the world? We say, yes, we can. And in Spanish, that is, si se puede. Say that, si se puede. So let's all do this with an organized hand clap, because we have to take responsibility, and then we have to work together to make it happen. Let's go. Si se puede. Si se puede.
Si se puede.
Muchas gracias. Thank you. Thank you. No?
Oh, yeah. I think we have about 10 to 15 minutes for questions. So I'll go ahead and announce it. Thank you, Dolores. We have about 10 to 15 minutes for questions. So we do have that one mic up there. We don't have a roving mic today. So anyone that wants to ask a question, if you could please go up there to the mic where Patrick is standing and get in line, and we'll try to get as many questions as we can in the next 10 to 15 minutes.
Communities, especially farm workers, and how can we fight this?
Well, I think one of the big problems would be that if people don't have like a regular permanent address, it would be very difficult for them. I know a lot of farm workers just have P.O. boxes. And I'm assuming that here, as I said before, I don't know whether you have unemployment insurance for farm workers or not. I know that most of the states of the United States do not have. I think we only, I know California, I think they have some kind of a similar, or kind of not quite the full limit of law in Texas and Arizona. But I think it would make it very difficult for farm workers. And it's kind of voter suppression. It's just like what they're doing in Georgia. They did the same, they're doing the same thing in Georgia. I know it affects the Native American reservations a lot. You know, because in terms of their ability to be able to vote. And it's kind of a hypocrisy when we're out there telling people that we want to install democracy in other countries, and here we're kind of taking away democracy in the United States of America for people having the ability to vote. So it's everything is going backwards, and it's a whole control thing, what they're doing and trying to see how many people they can keep from voting. So I hope that the legislature does defeat that initiative that they have now. That proposition. And I just want to say to everybody here that, you know, one of the ways that we have to be accountable is to, you know, keep on top of our representatives. Like if everybody in this room were to send a letter to your state representative tomorrow or give him a phone call or give him a visit to his office or her office, that they'll pay attention. Because they know any time that they get a letter from a constituent, that letter represents about 20 voters. And so if they get 100 letters on any issue, they're going to pay attention. For instance, right now we have this fellow Sam Alito who is up for the Supreme Court. Well, one of the things that Alito did when he was in at Princeton, the university there, was to support a policy that kept African Americans out of the university. You know, so you know this guy has a really shady record when it comes to people of color and women. So I would hope that everybody in this room will send a letter or an email to their senators saying, "Do not vote for the confirmation of Sam Alito." Because those decisions on the Supreme Court are going to affect us for hundreds of years in the future. So we have to take responsibility. We have to wake up, you know, as Samuel Lou Hamer did, you know, told everybody, America, wake up. We've got to wake up and we've got to start paying attention to what's going on in our country right now, because our democratic rights and liberties are being eroded and taken away from us. And this is what happened in Nazi Germany. You know, people forget that Hitler was elected. He came out of an elected situation over there. It wasn't like a coup when he took control of Germany. So we have similar things that are happening here in our country, and we've got to pay attention and wake up. And don't, you know, when every time they start attacking an immigrant or a gay and lesbian or a woman's right to choose, and say, where are you coming from? Okay, these are the real issues over here. Actually, I have a son who's an attorney, so also. So.
I wanted to ask you, amongst the indictments that you've had about, that you've shared about globalization, are there any positive aspects that you see to globalization? And if so, would you identify those and talk with us about how those can be reinforced?
Well, I think that the skills that we have here in the United States, that we've developed, you know, all of the innovations that we do, we should, you know, share these with other countries and give them to them, you know, and help them in terms of raising their own economies, but not just trying to control their economies. I think that's what's wrong. We could do so much more if we had, say, like we have the Peace Corps in a way, but do it more like an economic Peace Corps or an industrialization Peace Corps, that we actually go in there and help people out, you know, instead of just trying to figure out how we can make money off of their backs or off their economies. If we had some other kind of a goal instead of a profit goal, if our goal was one of helping. And that would actually make the whole world better anyway, you know, in the long run. Maybe in the short run, people would make a lot of money, but then that shouldn't be our goal. And the other thing that we have to think about when we talk about this is, how do we do this by not destroying our planet in the process, you know? Because of the environmental risks that we have right now, our CO2 levels, you know, the Earth's water is warming. We've had all these hurricanes that we've seen. And they're not predicting that we're going to have hurricanes like this for the next 40 years or something. That's the last thing I heard. And that is very scary. So we've got to think of, we impose our values on other countries, that we, that these be the good values of our country and not the values that are going to destroy the planet. Germany, Japan, and the United States use 75% of the world's resources because of our lifestyles, right? And if other countries don't want to adopt our lifestyle, we'll go bomb them, right? You know, we'll lop a bomb on them. So, you know, we've got to look at these things. And when we think globally, we have to think of the environment also. You know, we're going to be running out of water for what, you know, and yet we are so wasteful here in our country. And we have our materialistic society where we're told to buy and buy and buy. And then we have to get storage sheds to put our stuff in, right? Because we have so much stuff. And then we have to have yard sales to sell the stuff that we don't want. So we've got to think differently. We've got to think about living more simply and thinking of saving our planet, you know? Sure.
This is going to be popular.
That's okay. Well, what I mentioned before is that a lot of the people that are coming in from other countries are coming in because of our own policies. I don't think nobody wants to leave their home and go somewhere else unless they absolutely have to. People don't come, they come because they're escaping poverty, they're escaping hunger. And a lot of that is because of our policies here in the United States. When you consider that, could I finish? Could I finish?
Sure.
Okay. When we consider that Mexico and Latin America have been our neighbors for all of these hundreds of years. And what have we ever done to really help those economies instead of just exploiting them? You know, we really haven't done very much. And I'm going to just, and you won't like what I'm going to say right now, but you know, we have a saying in the Latino community that says, we didn't cross the border crossed us, right? We're the indigenous people. We're the indigenous people of the continent because we were here first. But there were, you know, there were trails from the Mexican Indians, all the way from South America, all the way to Michigan and to the Midwest. These were trading routes for the indigenous peoples. So you have to remember that you all are the newcomers. We were here before. We were here before you came here, okay, before your people came here. What's right about America is when I criticize my country, because I'm a patriot, because I believe in pointing out what is wrong, not what needs to be corrected, and that's what a true patriot is, you know. And one of the things that's good about America is that I can stand here, and I'm not talking about the citizens. I think the citizens of this country are really good people. I mean, the Farm Workers Union, the farm workers out there, we never would have gotten those first union contracts. And I know there are people here in this room, like Barbara, we were talking earlier, the walk picket lines for the farm workers. It said, don't buy grapes. And there's many of you in this room that I know that you're either you didn't buy any grapes or your parents didn't let you buy any grapes, right? And by doing that simple act of not buying grapes, 14 million Americans didn't buy grapes. Farm workers got toilets in the fields, something that they never had, that the growers never gave them. Drinking water, cold drinking water, you know, the right to negotiate their wages. And that was a great act. We have a great country. We have a great country, but we need to correct what's wrong to make it better. We don't have a true democracy when people's voting rights are being taken away from them. You know, we don't have a true democracy. We've got to make this a better democracy. And when we want democratic institutions in the world, then we've got to have a true democratic institution in our own country. If not, we're just hypocrites. Well, that's part of the racism, right? You don't see any Minutemen at the Canadian border at all, you know? They're down at the Mexican border. And these people are like vigilantes. I kind of liken them to the KKK, like the Ku Klux Klan, because it's a straight racist operation that they're doing, and people have got to be, they've got to be told that what they're doing is wrong. And you've got to counter it and just, you know, and not be afraid to counteract that. I think a lot of times things stay wrong because we don't counteract them. I'm going to talk specifically, I mentioned a little bit about the attack on gays and lesbians. When I was on the Kerry campaign, and I remember we were told not to bring up the issue of the attacks on gays and lesbians. We've all got to stand up and fight for people, right? when we see that something is wrong, whether they're immigrants, whether they're gays and lesbians or whatever, but we've got to stand up and fight for people. So I think you've got to do that. Form an organization, form a group of people to go to the radio stations, you know, do a press conference, do a vigil, find out where the Minutemen are at and confront them. They were recently in San Diego, and there were so many young Latino students that went there that, you know what, the Minutemen didn't even show up. They were afraid to show up, you know? So you've got to confront them and not let them get away with it. Thank you for the question.
One last question.
My name is Lucy Bonnet, and I work in the Heartland with farm workers. My students are farm workers. And my biggest concern is that they're not the students that are on that pandemic. What kind of future do they have as far as getting higher education? The biggest roadblock right now is not being able to go to college, and that's a big concern.
Well, we were lucky in California because our governor, Gray Davis, before the Terminator came in, who just got terminated, by the way, in this last election. But we actually passed a law in California to allow the undocumented students to be able to go to college. And I believe in Texas they have the same law that they can go to college. We're still trying to fight the DREAM Act so that they will be able to get financing to be able to go to college. But we have a lot of those young people that, first of all, they were brought here as babies and they, you know, had no choice. And they proved to be very, very bright in school, and we are actually depriving our own society of their contributions. But I think you have to fight for a law to pass that law that they will be able to go to school. Another thing that they did in California, they set up what they call the Hispanic University, where the children are going to be able to go to school there, and they're doing very well. Thank you very much. Well, thank you all very much for listening to me, and thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
I just want to make one point prior to closing and thanking Dolores. You know, the job of the Columbus Council on World Affairs is to be nonpartisan and to bring speakers that encourage a lot of debate about these issues. And I really want to thank the gentleman in the back for the questions that you asked and for expressing your viewpoint, because what makes this organization great and what makes this country great is the fact that Dolores can stand up here and give her viewpoint, and you can stand up here and give your viewpoint, and we can have this kind of debate and leave here thinking about these issues. So really, I thank you sincerely. You know.
I want to add one more thing here, and this is also going to be controversial probably, but there's a lot of attacks on Venezuela right now, on Hugo Chavez by the United States. Well, what is Hugo Chavez doing? He's using the revenues of the country, the oil revenues of the country, to build schools, to build up the infrastructure, to give small businesses loans, you know, to get more women in the legislature. This is what Hugo Chavez is doing. And why is the U.S. mad at him? Because he made the oil companies pay their taxes to the country that they weren't paying before, you know. And so when we see that they're providing a health and education for the people of their country, then we have to say to the United States of America, we want you to do the same here in the United States as Hugo Chavez is now doing in Venezuela. Si se puede. Thank you.
On behalf of the council, that's a small gift.
Thank you, Louise. Appreciate that.